Sean Vestal was doing some research for a story recently. He's a writer. And he came across this odd phrase in an old advertisement. And something about it just grabbed him. Now, this might have happened to you, not necessarily with a phrase, maybe a piece of music or a scent. You like something for reasons that are hard to explain. And Sean, keep in mind, this is a guy who explains stuff for a living.
I liked it immediately, and I don't. You know, if I was to say why, I'd be explaining it. I mean, I just reacted to it in some visceral way. I just liked it.
Sometimes we're just drawn to things, viscerally, sometimes even over our own objections or over other people's. And as you'll see in the stories coming up today, we sometimes like these things to the point of obsession. Welcome to Tales from the Fair, a special edition of The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Jessica Robinson. We're bringing you a series of short fictional stories commissioned by the Spokesman Review. Spokane area authors wrote around the theme of the fair, and today the fair serves as a backdrop for three stories about people who are drawn to things in ways they can't always explain. Coming up, writers Jessica Holliday and Samuel Ligon. But first, a story that takes its name from that odd phrase that Sean Vestal found. It's called All Weaknesses Peculiar to Men. Here's John.
His favorite combinations were the contradictions, the strange ones. Braziers and pistols, windmills and bustles. He would scissor the images with an exactitude he found calming, seeking the perfect separation from the page. A quarter-sawed rocking chair, a bottle of cocoa wine, a jar of bust cream. Every collage took longer than the last. He would adjust the images, tilt and shift, and look again, and set the paste aside. Every time when he finally pressed the images together and felt the paste smear under the paper, he sensed an irrevocable mistake. He had missed it. He should have been more patient, and now it was too late. They destroyed the rail yards, dug it all up, hauled in all that hippie crap, and invited every fallen idol. Nixon, the Soviets. He had loved the rail yards and the laundry on the island bluff. He had loved the hard metal space of it, the clang and clash, the coupling and uncoupling. You could smell the fuel. All that human industry, rendering the humans insignificant. And now it was all green, the tilting, skirted tower, the huge, colorful butterflies, all that hippie crap. Crowds swarming, ants on a crumb, the rail yards gone. The world, the old world, the right one, vanishing. He stared at the images, the lady's Edgemere bicycle from the 1902 catalog, the pleated gentleman's trousers, 1964. He tilted and shuffled. How did they fit? Women's swimsuits, 1937, a slim effect for larger figures. A cloth-covered child's platform horse, 1921. He was sure they fit if he could only see correctly. The images taken from the catalogs his mother had refused to throw away, the stacks of Sears and Roebuck. Whenever the catalogs would arrive, it had been like a holiday. He and his mother on the worn velvet settee, a whole afternoon slowly turning pages. Look here, Horace. See here. Some sort of music came flying brassily across the city, some kind of hubbub from down there. He tried to arrange the men's trousers over or alongside the lady's bicycle, and then over or alongside the platform horse, but the images would not cohere. He went back to the stacks with his scissors and trimmed out a pair of lumpy, colorful platform shoes from the newest catalog, 1973. Fencing foils, 1936. The Heidelberg electric belt from 1902, promising the most wonderful relief and cure of all chronic and nervous diseases, all diseases, disorders, and weaknesses peculiar to men. He decided he should go see it for himself. He trimmed his mustache, combed Vitalis into his hair. He wore his father's gray summer weight mohair and cotton suit, with moth holes on the shoulders and cigarette burns on the lap, and his burnished brown Oxfords. He left his apartment, walked downstairs, and headed toward the chaos. Warm out, with a lightning breeze. The Oxfords were a size too large, an odd hollowness in the toe with every step. A man of 61 in his father's shoes, fluttering with anxiety at the thought of other people. The crowds are unbearable. the way people dress, sloppy and filthy, girls bouncing around inside their clothes, boys with shirts half unbuttoned. He edges into the park beneath the enormous butterfly contraptions. Everything feels opened up here now, revealed, too bright. Flags, statues, invisible dogs, the unrelieved chitter of voices. He can smell the grassy odor of growing things and a heavy drift of fried foods. People ride on moving chairs overhead. Dancers from Japan perform in bright red dress. A photographer aims at them and waits. Someone jostles Horace. He dislikes being touched by others. All manner of people surround him in foreign colors and styles and sounds, and he imagines the exotic world, the hateful world, the intruding world. The Orient, Africa, mystery, disorder. When he comes to it, to the Soviet pavilion, he is astonished at its size, as large as any building in town, practically. A man bumps into him, eating some sort of fried hot dog on a stick, and Horace is flooded with the man's odor, with the grotesque fried smell and the oily meat smell, and then the man himself, the smell of his flesh and his sweat and his hair. The man looks at Horace and makes an apology face, mouth full, chewing happily, and Horace hisses, "Excuse you." A sneaker wave of nausea splashes in his guts, and his vision wavers. He stops to simply breathe. The corndog man moves closer, horribly closer, moves right into his face, and now the corndog man is helping him, guiding him, comforting him, calling him buddy. Inside the Soviet pavilion, it is cool and dark, and Horace recovers his breath. The corndog man is gone at last, and Horace cannot believe what he sees, a giant bust of Lenin, an enormous Lenin's head, right here, right in the park, right in Spokane, right in America. Giant. Triumphant. There is something unnameable in it. In the center of the pavilion is a tree thing with a canopy of branching electric filament. He stands and walks along the outer edge of the exhibition, behind the plaques and signs, and from ahead, around a curve, he hears a conversation. A man he cannot see is speaking English, but it's all funny. "Yes, yes, I understand completely," the funny voice is saying. "Oh, good," says an American voice, a normal voice, and the sound of it lifts Horace somehow. "It is just the routine flight pattern for the base," the voice says. There's a pause, and the funny voice says, "But yes, again, sir, why are your bombers flying over our pavilion?" Horace stands still, so very still, but he cannot achieve the silence he feels is called for. His breath rasps, heart pounds everywhere, noisy in his fingertips. He cannot understand the words the normal voice is saying now, in tones of warmth and friendliness, but he feels that he no longer needs to. He understands perfectly. He is elated, and he fears the sound of his pumping, pumping blood will give him away, will make it impossible to hear the bombers approaching, coming to set things right. But before the thought is even complete, he sees the flaw in it, sees that he has gotten it wrong again. Outside, a man is taking photographs of the enormous gray relief map of the USSR. The man's hair is grown down over the collar of his denim shirt, a shirt made of pants. The shutter clicks and he winds it with a thumb. Something washes away inside of Horace. He wants that man's photos. He sees a woman aiming a boxy, odd camera at two children. "No, Jack, no," she says laughingly. "Smile." The camera whirs and spits something out, and the children gather around their mother to look. And Horace wants to take away their photograph before it appears, to run home with it, to cut it up. He buys a program for $2 damn. The cover is a mess of color, a sharp, offensive brightness. Back home, Horace pours through the pages, but there is no image of the Russian pavilion, no image of the giant bust of Lenin or the eerie electric tree. He sits in his recliner, TV tray before him. He takes his scissors to the cover, freeing the images of the sloping tower, the river, the flags of the world. Maybe it hadn't been so bad after all. The day is dying outside, graying. He trims from the inside pages, the ads, the roster of entertainers. apples and cotlets, Lawrence Welk, Kaiser, Myrna Loy. Darkness drifts in grain by grain, filling the room. Potlatch, Liberace, Sambo's. He can barely see a thing now. He fills his hands with pieces of program. He brushes the images with his fingertips. No, he tells himself, not so bad. He can barely see a thing now, but he wants no light.
Sean Vestal, reading a story called All Weaknesses Peculiar to Men. Sean says he'd had this idea about a strange old collagist sort of swirling around in his head.
To me, Horace was just a person who had become a little bit trapped in the way he related to the objects that were important to him. He had a little circle when he walked that circle, and that going to the fair disturbed it. And then he returned to it in a way. But I say that as though that was my thinking, and that's what I think now, having finished it and looking back on it. In the composition, you're just trying to inch forward somehow.
Sean Vestal is a columnist for the Spokesman Review and the author of Godforsaken Idaho. That book won Sean a major award this year, the Penn Robert W. Bingham Award for Debut Fiction. Next up, it's hard to tell which is stronger, the G-forces of a carnival ride or the magnetic power of the cool girl. Here's Jessica Holliday.
Tracy Tasker was everything everyone wanted to be. She was a sixth grader. She had a boyfriend. She wore a bra. Before we saw her, I was everything everyone wanted to be, at the fair with no parents, my only order to keep Nathan off the scary rides. I told Nathan he could hang out with me as long as he didn't act stupid, to which he said, "You have to watch me, Mom said," to which I said, "Who's Mom going to believe when I tell her you ran off?" To which he said something stupid, but I couldn't hear it because that's when I saw her, Tracy, Ricky's arm draped over her neck. They cut right in front of Nathan and me waiting in line for the teacups, without slowing, like they knew the crowd would part for them because they were Tracy and Ricky. Nathan started to say something, so I put my hand over his mouth. He bit me. "Knock it off," I said, jerking my hand back. "You almost killed me," he said, too loud, but it didn't matter because they were already past, and we were up next in line. I grabbed Nathan's arm and pulled him out of line. "But it's our turn," he said. He locked his knees to fight me, but he's like 50 pounds and his arms are made out of spaghetti. I just gave him a hard jerk and he stumbled across the dirt behind me, saying something else stupid, which I ignored. I could see the back of them, Tracy's hot pink tube top bright in the crowd. I kept my eyes on it and not the people staring at the yelling boy I dragged behind me. They stopped at the zipper, considering the long line. I prayed, but God wasn't listening, of course. Why would God listen to a child abuser? They joined the end of the line. "What are you doing? We can't go on that," Nathan said. I didn't answer, because I didn't answer him anymore, it seemed. I just pulled him after me, tensing for a fit. But Nathan was staring up at the spinning cars flipping around as the zipper rotated. I positioned us in line behind Tracy and Ricky, praying, because I guess I thought God would eventually take pity on me, that Nathan would remain amazed enough by the scariest ride at the fair that he wouldn't attract any more attention. I examined Tracy. I put all my weight on my right foot and jutted my hip out the way she was doing, which wasn't exactly easy, considering I had to keep my death grip on Spaghetti Arm so he wouldn't ruin everything. I cursed my mother, who bought my clothes from Evelyn's children's store instead of Penny's, because Evelyn's was classy and Penny's was typical. I considered praying that she would get in a car crash on her way to pick us up from the fair and die when the gas tank exploded. But I figured if God wasn't listening about the normal stuff, he wasn't going to up and give me a miracle. Ricky put his mouth up against Tracy's ear and said something, and she rolled her eyes, elbowing him away from her. I memorized how she did it. Ricky thought he was the cool one and was going to make her giggle and lean in. At least that's what I would do if he did that to me, or that's what I would have done, but now I knew better. Then she looked over her shoulder. "Hey, Natalie," she said. She didn't turn around or anything, just gave me the "Hey, Natalie," and then turned back to face forward because it was their turn to get in the car for the ride. That's when I realized God might not grant miracles, but he certainly punishes child abusers, because each car had four people in it, and I hadn't considered that when I got in line right behind Tracy and Ricky. "Come on," the guy at the front of the line said, holding the door open. What was I going to do? I dragged Nathan toward the car. The guy let go of the door and grabbed Nathan by the shoulder. "He's too short," he said, pointing to the line painted on the entry gate. "Gotta be 48 inches. As the guy dropped the security latch on the car, I leaned away from the kid who took Nathan's place beside me and looked through the mesh to see that for once, Nathan was not acting stupid, standing right where I told him to wait. When it was over, 5 minutes until the end of all time, the guy threw open the door and moved to the next car and we got out. Or Tracy, Ricky, and the jerk who kept prying my hands off his arm and telling me to shut up the entire time we were whizzing upside down and sideways through hell did. I wasn't deaf. I mean, I heard someone telling me to get out. Maybe a few people. Maybe even Tracy leaned back in to tell me to get out. But I didn't care anymore because there was no caring. There was no guilt about Nathan, who I could no longer see. There was no longing for my own tube top and boyfriend and incinerated mother. There was only the black at the sides of my vision and the saliva in my mouth. I felt hands on my arms and figured it was God's personal assistant, yanking me out of the car to put me in the incinerator for my Oscar-worthy performance of the worst human on the planet. But God's personal assistant was really on his game that day. The hands on my arms were Tracy's and Ricky's. The voices, almost even friendly voices, telling me it was going to be okay, were Tracy's and Ricky's. The buzzing around in the background was Nathan, and he was safe, and it was over. And I had new friends, and I was the one they were worried about. God's personal assistant, who I later figured out was actually Satan, had me in the palm of his hand. He had my whole world in his hands. The vomit came up with blazing speed, forcing my mouth open wide, wider than I would have thought possible. The 7 Tim's Tiny Donuts and the foot-long Polish dog with sauerkraut and the caramel corn were still near-perfect versions of their original selves, easy to recognize against the hot pink of Tracy's tube top. The sounds that followed, though, were not. Screeching and retching and a deep-voiced F-word joined in one master soundtrack playing backwards, Satan's County Fair mix. In the end, it was just me and Nathan, who had morphed into God's personal assistant's personal assistant. Offering up grace and understanding and paper napkins he'd grabbed from the hot dog counter, there was nothing in the universe at that moment that could possibly make me feel worse. "Can we still go on the teacups?" he asked.
That was Jessica Holliday. The title of that story is Satan's County Fair Mix. Jessica says this story combines her own miserable experience on the zipper and the pain of her own teenage sartorial longing.
I wasn't allowed to have a tube top. And the other girls were, and oh, I wanted a tube top. They were so cool.
Jessica Holliday teaches at Gonzaga University. Her work has appeared in The Sun, Copper Nickel, and Knockout Literary Journal. Our next author is Samuel Ligon with a love story, but he says he wasn't interested in writing a cheesy love story.
I actually saw an image of this bearded woman who was kind of beautiful. And I thought, wow, what if there was a kid who fell in love with a bearded woman? And I was interested in the sexual ambiguity of it, too, that this kid falls in love with her, but doesn't recognize it as at all transgressive or weird in any way.
Here's Sam with his absurdist and, just a warning, slightly twisted love story.
I met Sheena at Wonderland, a traveling carnival that took me in when I ran from home. We'd pull into town and I'd set up the sideshow booths, haul swag and stock vendors, and when the run was over, I'd break it all down. I was 16 years old, as strong as any man there. Sheena was the bearded lady, the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. I didn't know how much there was to want in the world until I saw her, and then I wanted it all. My father broke 7 bones in me before I was 15. He didn't have any goodness in him except when he sang Hank Williams or George Jones mournful songs of lost love and heartache. He sang like an angel, and when he was done singing, he'd cry for my mother, and when he was done crying, he'd come after me. I felt all his sorrow and loss the night I left home. He came at me with an axe handle, and while I'd be badly bruised, I was able to pull myself from the floor and run. Hours later, I saw Sheena on her trailer steps at Wonderland, and something broke in me for good, some brittle thing I didn't know was there. And then it just kept breaking. I didn't know a woman could have such glowing skin, such carriage. Her beard wasn't heavy or long like Stonewall Jackson's, but delicate, wispy, crow purple black. On her sideshow board, she was a hairy demon, eyes popping from her head, but in the flesh, she was powerful and fragile, her hair cut in a perfect Prince Valiant. Every time I saw her, I felt born again. The country hit that summer was "You're Not Woman Enough to Be My Man," Lonesome Kitty Valor's voice pouring over the hot metal and cotton candy of Wonderland. I'd see Sheena and my lungs would collapse. I hadn't been on the road 2 weeks and already I was a freak. I was glad I hadn't killed my father and sorry I'd waited so long to run, wondering how much of myself I'd lost to him. I'd sit outside Sheena's trailer at night, listening to Kitty Valor's song about men and women and women and men, and I'd wonder if any of us had a chance in this world. Sometimes a man would wait for her out back of the sideshow. Sometimes she'd bring him home. I'd been moving my sleeping bag closer to her door, and when the rain came slashing out of the mountains, she told me to bed down on the dry ground under her trailer. "I'd let you sleep inside," she said, "but I'm having company." I knew about her company. I knew what men paid her for, and I heard them above me that night, the animal noises they made, hollowing me. The rain was so heavy, I didn't dare come out. Later, when she said it was time for him to leave, and he said, "I don't think so," I crawled into the rain, listening hard. "No," she said, "stop it." I opened the door and she was thrashing, one of his big paws over her mouth. She bit him and he slapped her. "Put her down," I said, and he said, "or what?" Sheena twisted and he twisted with her. I punched him in the kidneys the way my father punched me. I punched him until he let Sheena go. He ran out the door, looking back with fear in his eyes, which satisfied me and made me sick. The punches I'd thrown crackled in my hands and shoulders. I'd probably never be woman enough for Sheena now. But when I turned, she was setting a long-barreled revolver on her kitchen counter. "Thanks," she said. "I appreciate your concern." "I guess you had it covered," I said, nodding toward her cowboy gun. She was wearing this black silky thing, a slip maybe. My eyes were pulled all over her. I concentrated on her beard. "It's still raining," she said. "Why don't you sleep on the floor here?" "All right," I said, and I lay on her floor, breathing her molecules while she slept on the other side of an accordion door. The next night, she was drinking beer out front of her place. "You want one?" she said, looking me up and down. "Sure," I said. "One beer won't hurt anything," she said. We drank one beer at her dinette and then a bottle of whiskey, every cell in my body vibrating with her. She put on some hillbilly music and we danced, rubbing against each other. I couldn't breathe enough of the air around her. We sat at her dinette and she told me about her first whisker, about shaving and worrying until she realized her beard was her fortune. "Do you want to touch it?" she said. Of course I wanted to touch it. It was soft as could be, her skin around it softer still. "It wasn't the first thing I noticed about you," I said. "What was?" "How you hold yourself," I said. "So proud. I was afraid of you." "You should be afraid of me," she said. "I don't want to be afraid of you." "Then you don't know what love is," she said. She gathered a bowl of warm water,
a straight-edge razor. Love should scare the hell out of you, she said, lathering me, her sweet smell all around. She shaved me, humming against my ear. Does that feel good, she said, but I couldn't talk. She flicked the edge of the blade against my cheek, bringing up blood. Don't move, she said. She took a pinch of salt from a bowl on the table, patting it against my face, licking it into my wound. And when she kissed my mouth, all that salt and blood and breath mixed between us. I'd never kissed a woman before and couldn't stop. Now you do me, she said, handing me the razor, but don't take too much. I took a dip from her beard, then cut and salted her, licked her wound and kissed her and kept kissing her. When I woke in the morning, she was warm against me. I'd never known I could fit someone like that. All my troubles were behind, it seemed. We couldn't imagine the ways we'd hurt each other down the road, all our suffering a million miles from the mystery we were grabbing after now. You're not a freak, she said a few nights later as we lounged on her trailer bed, but I like you anyway. I am a freak, I said. Our faces were cross-hatched pink and purple and red. You can say you are, she said. And you can say you are, I said. She handed me the razor. I lathered her and shaved a wisp of her beard away. Don't take too much, she said. I looked at her beautiful face, her beard, her translucence. I loved the way she talked and listened, the way she looked at me, her smell. I loved everything about her. I'm taking it all, I said. She looked at me. We looked at each other. You can grow another one, I said. She closed her eyes and sat straight on the edge of the bed, tilting her head so I could make a clean job of it. I took my time, careful not to cut her, while she hummed against me the most beautiful song I'd ever heard.
That was Samuel Ligon with the story Wonderland. There's a famous Loretta Lynn song called You're Not Woman Enough to Steal My Man, but Sam says for this story, he decided to tweak that song a little for his made-up singer, Kitty Valor.
Her song title is You're Not Woman Enough to Be My Man. So I love that gender ambiguity in the piece too, which feels out of place too. It's a disconnect in country music. We wouldn't really see that in country music.
Samuel Ligon has a book of short stories called Drift and Swerve. His novel is titled Safe in Heaven Dead. He teaches at Eastern Washington University.
You say I ought to know that he don't love me anymore and I'll have to let him go. You say you're gonna...
Tales from the Fair is produced by Spokane Public Radio. These stories originally appeared in the Spokesman Review and were edited by Carolyn Lamberson. I'm Jessica Robinson. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time for the final three stories from Beth Cooley, Gregory Spatz, and Leah Satilli.
Everyone knew the fair changed at night, that in the dark, it belonged to the clowns.